A Sabbath afternoon. You're seated cross-legged on one of the prayer rugs in a little synagogue in a townlet in Morocco. Everyone in the village is crowded into the synagogue. Men, women, children, farmers, stall keepers, school teachers. Why have they come? The Magid, the storyteller, has come to town. Who is the Magid? He is part poet and part preacher, part troubadour and part teacher. He is the Torah Shebaal Peh, the living literature of our people. He will tell us this afternoon the legends, the folk tales, the living stuff of Jewish history. It's not history, but it's history as it was told and retold over the long generations. He will tell us of Torah, but not of the Torah that we know, its philosophy, its doctrine, its depths. But the highlights, the elemental facts, the stories, which were part of the tapestry of Jewish life. He will tell us of Rabbi Abraham Ibn Ezra, poet, writer of hymns, mathematician, astronomer, one of the most artistic and aesthetic of the medieval giants of our people. But he will not tell us of Rabbi Abraham's Talmudic erudition, nor of his biblical commentaries. He will tell us of the legendary foibles of the man, of his biography, of his person. He will begin by quoting to us one of the sardonic autobiographical little poems of Ibn Ezra. "'Twas sure a luckless planet that ruled when I was born. I hope for fame and fortune. I have but loss and scorn. An evil fate pursues me with unrelenting spite. If I sold lamps and candles, the sun would shine all night. I cannot prosper, no matter what I try. Were selling shrouds my business, no man would ever die." Abraham Ibn Ezra wrote great poetry. Some of the liturgy is from his pen. But he was not a practical man. His head was in the heavens, and his feet were not solidly planted on the ground. And the Magid would tell us that history reveals that Moses Maimonides, the medieval philosopher, and Abraham Ibn Ezra, the medieval poet, were born in the selfsame moment and the selfsame day in the selfsame year. But Maimonides was born as the wheel of fortune was rising. He was a man destined for fame and for wealth. And Ibn Ezra was born as the wheel of fortune was falling. He was destined to wander the world, seeking desperately to keep body and soul together. If Ibn Ezra bought when goods were cheap, the bottom fell out of the market. Now, Ibn Ezra and Maimonides, the Magid, would tell us were friends. And Maimonides tried to give Ibn Ezra good advice, when to buy and when to sell, but somehow between the advice and the act, something always went wrong. Finally, Maimonides decided that he would give his friend a gift. He would set him up. But he could not simply give him money. Ibn Ezra was too proud to receive charity. So he devised the scheme to leave on Ibn Ezra's doorstep late one night a purse heavy with gold and silver coin. He knew that Ibn Ezra would get up before dawn to go to the synagogue for his morning prayers. He would pass the sill of his door. He would find the purse. The purse would be his. And so he did. But that very same night, Ibn Ezra was philosophizing. He realized his poverty. He realized he had never been able to make a living. But he began to think to himself, you know, I'm not so badly off. Far better to be a poor man and open-eyed than to be a rich man and blind. And the more he thought on his good fortune, the more he was convinced of it. And he determined as a vow to prove his good fortune that the next morning he would walk to the synagogue with his eyes shut tight. And the bruisings and the stumblings would be proof that truly God smiled upon him. And you know the rest. He walked directly over the purse, never seeing it. Maimonides, for all his good intentions, was not able to do the good turn for his friend. And this is only one of 10,000 tales which are taken from the living literature of the people. The stories mothers told their children, the stories school teachers told their pupils long after the textbooks were put aside. The stories told by the Magidim on a Sabbath afternoon in the synagogue. These stories are largely passing from our own knowledge. Our own education draws to us a literature, a folk literature from many cultures. It is systematic education. We no longer need the free university. We are told and what is good to read, and librarians present to us a list for each year of our growth which tells us exactly what stories we should respond to. We have forgotten, we Jews of Europe, this literature. It is still alive among the Jews of North Africa, the Jews of Yemen and of Iraq, but for how long we do not know. They brought this literature to Israel. The Hebrew University has sent out among their professional and amateur storytellers to tape record this living classic literature of our people, so at least it may be preserved. Their children and their grandchildren will probably know the world as we know it, the folk literature of Scandinavia, of Europe, of Asia, as well as our own. But this whole rich tapestry, this woven fabric of Jewish life, will, I'm afraid, disappear. And I simply want to dip into it with you this morning to let you taste that wonderful classic literature which was never written down, but which informed the heart and the mind and the soul of our people over the long centuries. Now, as you know, we're a bookish people. We have the great classic texts, the Bible, the Talmud, the Midrash, the medieval philosophies. We are proud of erudition and of learning. But it's interesting to note that in the Talmud, whenever the question is asked, Eizehu Chacham, who is a wise man? The answer is never given in terms of degrees earned or texts mastered. Wisdom is the ability to see opportunity, connections, possibilities, where the more simple mind sees only frustration, an obstacle, a challenge which cannot be overcome. Eizehu Chacham, who is the wise man? When this rhetorical question was asked, one man answered, Haroa et hanolad, the man who sees that which will be, the opportunities. Some men read the headlines and see only the simple fact. The wise man reads the headlines and connects it with history, with the human condition. The man who reads the headlines and sees only the fact reacts emotionally, instinctively, thoughtlessly. The man who connects the fact to the social condition reacts with judgment, reasonably and intelligently. The wise man, then, is the man who can foresee the whole range of possibility and relate facts to their context. When the question is asked a second time, the answer is this, Eizehu Chacham, who is the wise man, Hamakayem Talmudo. The wise man is the man who translates his learning into living. There is no virtue in knowing all that you can know about the statistics of poverty, of urban blight, of cultural deprivation, of piling fact upon fact, if you do not guide your community towards eliminating this social and economic curse. There is no virtue in learning if it remains in the head, if it does not translate into a life, into an active life, into citizenship. Finally, when they asked the question, Izehu Chacham, who is the wise man? The rabbis answered, Hamlamed Mikol Adam. The wise man is the man who can learn from every other man, from every experience, from every situation, and from every relationship. Now, it is wisdom at this level with which this folk legend, the folk tales of our people deal. There is no fine-spun logic here, simply illustration after illustration, moving tale after unforgettable tale. There is no theory, only life in the raw, life as this impoverished but proud people lived it over the long centuries. Our common human problem is the child who will not accept the yoke of his responsibilities. The young man who has many talents, but is carefree, careless. Now, I suppose if we were educational theoreticians, we would say that this young man needs to be exposed to a wide variety of vocational opportunities which may be meaningful to him. The Magid simply told a story. The story is of a father who lived in Marrakesh, perhaps 80, perhaps 100 years ago. He had an only son. And this boy was of the grasshopper people. He delighted to dally with wine and with women and with song, and he had no interest in the father's business. Instead of settling down, beginning a family on his own. Now, some fathers disinherit their sons. Some fathers simply berate their sons so often that their sons turn a deaf ear to the father's counsel. This father had tried to instruct the boy. He had done everything he could. He still loved the boy. He had not cut him off. He tried to reach him, but he could not. Death approached. And this father drew the son to his bedside and said to the young lad, I love you, my boy. And I've tried to instruct you in the way that you should go, but you would have none of it. I will not now impose conditions upon you as a deathbed vow. I know that when I die, you would quickly break the vow. I would simply ask that you accept three calendar conditions, three matters of timing. They're not onerous, they're not burdensome. And I think that you would do yourself and me a great favor if you would accept them. What are they, my father? When you go to the coffee house to carouse with your friends, do not go before 2 o'clock in the morning. To this, the boy readily assented. When you go to the house of a woman of easy virtue, do not knock on her door until the cock crows. The lad again assented. And when you are angry, do not act on your anger until you have slept on it. And to this, too, the boy agreed. The father died. The days of mourning are completed. The young man decides to return to his friends in the coffee house. But he remembers the father's stipulation. He takes a nap. At midnight, he dresses. He goes to the coffee house and he sees there his friends, already drunken and sodden and incoherent. And he is no longer one of them. He is an outsider. And he turns from these erstwhile friends and returns to his home. Several days later, he decides to visit a woman friend. But again, he remembers the father's timetable. He goes to bed. He gets up just before dawn and he knocks on the door of a woman whose beauty he cherishes and remembers. And she opens the door, but her face is swollen with the ravages of a night. Her beauty is long gone. And without a word, the young man turns and returns to his home. He settles down. He enters business. He marries. Several months after he is married, a caravan takes him far away on the business of the family. He is gone for many months. He returns unexpectedly in the middle of the night. He tiptoes to his wife's bedroom. He hears her whispering endearments into the night. He grabs at his dagger. He's so filled with anger, he's ready to murder her. But he remembers his father's admonition, the third stipulation, and he quietly returns to his camels to return the next morning. At dawn, he enters the family villa, and he sees his mother playing with a little baby in the courtyard. "Whose child is this?" "Yours, my son. He was born while you were away on your journey." And then he realizes that the baby's crib was in the mother's room, and it was to the child that the mother was whispering her endearments. And the once prodigal son blesses the wise father. What would we say? There are more ways than one to skin a cat. There are more ways than one to educate a child, to help him to grow into his maturity. The Magid very rarely drew the moral of the story. He simply placed an unforgettable image before the people and let it sink in, and they could, as best they would, apply it in their lives. The Magid returned theology, abstract theology, into a story. The Jews whom he lived with lived among the Muslims. And the Muslims, much like the medieval Catholics, insisted that they controlled the keys to the kingdom, that no one except a Muslim could enter paradise. Now, the Jews, who have always believed that the righteous of any people have their place in heaven, always wondered at this exclusive property that other religions made of heaven. The story is told by one of these Magidim, of an Arab who happened to live on a road on the way to the Jewish cemetery. And whenever a Jewish funeral passed by, he heard the Jews say to one another, "Tzedakah tatzil mimavet," righteousness delivers from death. Now, he knew no Hebrew, and tzedakah sounded in his language, in Arabic, like taka, which is the word for a portal, a narrow gate. And he wondered why the Jews, as they went out to the cemetery, spoke always of taka, taka, of a portal. And he went to a businessman, a Jew whom he knew, and he asked him. The Jew tried to put the man off. He said, "It's a great religious secret, I can't tell you it." But the man would not be put off. And finally the Jew said, "Well, I'll tell you. This is the story. We Jews know that heaven is reserved for the Muslims, that you alone have the keys to the kingdom. But we have a great secret. We know that above the large gate into heaven, there's a very small portal cut into the wall, just enough for a soul to inch their way in. And we go behind our corpse to the cemetery to remind the corpse of this little hidden portal, that he can get into heaven." The more the Muslim thought of this taka, of this portal, the more disturbed he was that Jews should elbow their way in where they're not wanted. And what was his solution? He prepared his coffin. He put some clay and some mortar tools and a mortar board in the coffin. He took his dagger and plunged it into his breast to make sure that he would get to heaven to close up the portal before any Jew could enter into it. Now, I submit to you that that is theology served up so that anyone can understand it. Life for these Jews was difficult. The margin between survival and failure, between safety and exile, was a very narrow one. And many of these stories reflect the difficulties and yet the laughter through tears, which was the attitude of our people. Dayan, the judge, the rabbi of one of these little communities, ordered a new set of trousers. And the tailor promised him that he'd have the trousers ready within a week. A week passed by, and 3 days more. 3 days late, the tailor appeared with the trousers as ordered. The Dayan tried the trousers on, and they fit perfectly. They were well made, and he was very happy with them, and he paid for the goods. But then he turned to the little tailor, and he said, "Tell me, How is it that God required only 6 days to make the world, and you required 10 days to make a simple pair of trousers? The tailor thought for a moment and then answered, "My trousers fit perfectly, do they not? They are well made and without blemish. Look at the world." In this world, which was filled with difficulty and danger, the Jew longed for the Messiah, for safety. And he put all of his hopes into some divine intervention, into David coming down and bringing about the redemption of Israel. He could not see his political situation changed in any other way. The story is told of two elderly scholars. They had spent their life in study, in fasting, in prayer. Their piety was famous throughout the countryside. They were known as holy men, saints. And these two men dreamt of pushing the Messiah into coming. And they felt that because of their holiness, if they could go to the Holy Land, their prayers might somehow hasten his arrival. But they lived in Casablanca, 1,000 miles from Jerusalem. They had no money. And so they undertook a pilgrimage on foot, requiring many years to come to the Holy Land to pray for the coming of the Messiah. They traveled and they came. And such was their holiness that when they arrived in Jerusalem, Elijah came out to meet them. Elijah welcomed them to Jerusalem, and he said, "Such is your virtue that the cave of the grave of David has opened. If you will go down into this cave, you will see David lying upon his bier. He will raise one hand towards you. And if you take from a flagon of water which lies beside the coffin and pour it upon the hand of King David, he will arise, and the time of redemption will be at hand. But beware, the way into the cave is long, and the walls of the entrance are filled with gold and with silver, with all the allurements of the world. You are simple men. Do not be dazzled or bemused. Walk straight on, perform the deed, and our redemption will be here." The two pious men entered the cave, and they began to walk towards the bier, and there was David lying. He raised his hand toward them, and there was the flagon of water. But these two pious men were so dazzled by the shine, by the glory, by the yellowness, the coin, the gold, of the allurements around them, that they were as if they were in shock. They forgot the flagon of water. And as slowly, as surely as the arm had been extended, so was it returned and folded again upon the corpse of David. The Messiah has not yet come. The time of his arrival is still some time distant. May it please God that we as Jews remember to turn away from the beguilements and from the allurements of the material world, that we prepare our souls and our communities for his coming. So the Magid ended his story that late Sabbath afternoon. He spoke of the practical things in Jewish life. He spoke of the theology of Jewish life. He spoke of the heroes of Jewish life. He touched on the ethic of Jewish life. He was the embodiment of the living wisdom of Israel. And those who heard, learnt, even though they may not have been learned people. And it was in this way over the long generations that the rich traditions of our people were passed down from simple folk to simple folk. The Magid these legends helped them to live. In the book of Job, we read, "Where is the place of wisdom? And where can understanding be found?" Wisdom can be found in many places. It can be found in university, in libraries, in the conversation of scholarly people. And it can be found in the folk legend of a great people. Indeed, it is found there. And I commend this literature to you. Amen.